A requisition for a special general meeting has been called, and this meeting will be held after the consultation meeting at 6:30. After the meeting tonight, Ronnie Bowie is with us, and he's going to give us a brief talk about the merger proposals, and he's happy to take any questions about it that you might have. Also, a couple of dates for your diaries. The next OCF meeting will be held here on the 9th of April at 9 o'clock. Otto Thoresen, the CEO at Aegon, will be coming along to talk to us about the results of his review into the provision of generic financial advice. And the idea is that the format of this meeting will be a bit more of a question and answer session rather than a formal presentation of his findings. And then the final OCF meeting of the year will be held on the 19th of May at 5:30 at Resolutions Office through in Glasgow. And the topic for that one will be IFRS 2. Okay, so back to tonight's talk. This year, the current topics paper has been prepared by Deloitte, and we have five of the writers here to talk us through what's been happening with the main actuarial practice over the past year. I think we're aiming to finish the talk about 7:15 tonight, and then we'll open the floor to questions, and then we'll just hand over to Ronnie. Also, Deloitte has kindly put on some drinks for us tonight, so it's probably worth staying around to at least 7 o'clock. So I'll hand over to Peter Murphy from Deloitte to introduce the team of speakers. Thanks.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the current topics paper for 2008. The paper should be available on the Institute and Faculty's website over the next couple of days, just getting a couple of formatting things sorted. This evening I'm presenting on life insurance, Claire Edler is presenting on general insurance, Femi Bart-Williams and Matthew Argent are presenting on investments, and Nico at the far end is talking on pensions. So I'll start talking on life insurance. I think that, for me, one of the things that's obvious about 2007 is that there wasn't that much regulatory change actually happening throughout 2007. We can see here that there's lots and lots of change being planned, over the next few years, and there have been lots of discussions over this year. These changes under discussion are likely to lead to changes in all of the areas that we work in. Solvency II will affect regulatory reporting, IFRS will affect financial reporting. The BAS framework should affect almost everything we do. Treating customers fairly will change the way that we communicate with policyholders, and the retail distribution review will change our relationships with distributors. The timetable in the slide above just gives a rough indication of how some of these things are going to pan out over the next few years. There should be easily enough work to keep us busy for the next 4 or 5 years. The changes to the European embedded value rules and the implementation of TCF over 2008. Then in the next few years, we should see any changes from the RDR come through. And after that, we see the IFRS for insurance contracts currently timetabled for 2010 and Solvency II for 2012. We can see here new business premiums for life insurance over the past few years. These premiums have been increasing year on year for the past 4 years, if you also include 2007's figures, which aren't in this graph. Total premiums on an IPA basis are now up to about £15.1 billion, including £95.5 billion of single premiums. This was an increase in total premiums of 14% from 2007 compared to 2006. And 2007 in particular saw a marked increase in single premium business. However, much of this is likely to be transfers from existing pensions contracts. Taking this into account, the net flow into the industry was relatively negligible. The FSA see falling levels of real new business as a key risk for the life insurance industry. And this is an issue that is currently being addressed through various types of product innovation and through the retail distribution review. Due to the complexity of the products, the majority of long-term life insurance products are sold after a process of advice. This table here shows the split of business between whole of market and limited range advisors. This has been relatively stable over the past 5 years, and the marketplace for, however, the marketplace for distributors is likely to change over the next few years, leaving this graph with another new set of labels. I'll now very briefly talk about the retail distribution review. In an attempt to combat some of the perceived weaknesses in the current distribution model, the FSA set up the retail distribution review of the investment market. This was launched with a flourish by its chair, Callum McCarthy, in September 2006, and was in progress throughout 2007. The FSA issued its discussion paper in June 2007, in which it calls for the retail financial services market to develop, amongst other areas, remuneration structures that are transparent, understandable, and do not conflict with acting in the best interests of consumers. The discussion paper almost segments the market for the current market for providing advice, dividing it into the four tiers that are up on the slide. In the first of these advice segments, professional financial planners, the FSA suggests that advisors would only be able to operate on a fee basis, adding, for this purpose, we might redefine the term fee-based to mean any advisory remuneration derived in discussion with the customer. Generic financial advice was the subject of the Thoroughson Review report published earlier this month. This report sets out a high-level blueprint for a national money guidance service to provide the people of the UK with the knowledge, understanding and confidence to make better decisions about money issues. And you'll have the opportunity to hear much more about this when Otto comes to speak to us in a month's time. Now move on to corporate activity. The main M&A deal for the year was Resolution. The contest to see who will end up owning Resolution raged over most of the year, and it's still not quite finished. At the time of writing, Pearl are still trying to tie up their $5 billion takeover of the closed fund consolidator. After acquiring Rawson Alliance Life, Swiss Life, Britannic Group and Abbey's UK Life business in the period since 2004, Resolution became a takeover target itself in 2007. In July, Resolution agreed a merger with Friends Provident. This then prompted groups headed by Pearl, in conjunction with Royal London, and Standard Life, in conjunction with Swiss Re, to bid for Resolution. A hard-fought battle ended in November with victory for Pearl after it built up a stake of nearly 25% on the open market. The takeover will result in a business with assets under management of $85 billion. The failure of the merger with Resolution left Friends looking vulnerable to the takeover itself, and there have been persistent rumours that a bid might appear from JC Flowers. Another trend in 2007 has been the increasing concern over future trends in longevity. We have seen the consolidation of annuity liabilities to a number of firms with a great deal of expertise in this area. This slide shows some of the main deals that have occurred this year, and it's likely that there will be more deals next year. As sales of with-profits have reduced, companies have started to have to think about the purpose of the inherited estates that have built up in with-profits funds and whether they are necessary going forward. During 2007, both Aviva and the Prudential have started to consider reattribution of their free assets in their with-profits funds. Aviva have appointed Claire Spottiswood as policyholder advocate to help with the process of determining the correct way to distribute the $5 billion surplus that had accumulated by the end of 2006. So far, Aviva have decided to distribute more than $2 billion of this in the form of a special bonus, with the remainder to be distributed by the process of reattribution. At the time of talking, Aviva are still considering the policyholders' advocate's reply to their third offer, with the intention of finally putting an offer to policyholders in 2008. In 2008, the PRU are probably also likely to start to publish more detailed plans for their reattribution. And at the same time, the Treasury Select Committee have launched an inquiry into these reattributions, which is bound to influence the course of events. Next, we'll look at some of the regulatory developments that have happened this year. Treating customers fairly forms a key part of the FSA's flagship move to a more principle-based regulation. While the shift away from detailed rules provides firms with greater flexibility, it also results in greater uncertainty. To provide further TCF support to firms, the FSA published four papers in July, which we can see up here. For the provider and distributor relationships, the FSA suggests that providers should consider evaluating, through the use of MI, management information, the actual versus planned experience of distribution channels. Commercial realities mean that many providers are paying greater attention to the quality and conduct of their distribution. TCF management information continues to be a high priority for the FSA, with deadlines set at the end of this month for MI to be in place, and then for the end of December 2008 for MI to demonstrate customer outcomes are being delivered. The outcome on culture is probably the most important of the six TCF outcomes defined by the FSA. The paper states that consumers should be confident that they are dealing with firms where the fair treatment of customers is central to the corporate culture. The FSA has outlined a cultural framework based around key cultural drivers, which are believed to have significant influence on the way firms behave. These are leadership. The leaders of the firms have the most impact over a firm's culture by setting direction and monitoring performance. Then we look at strategy. TTF should form an integral part of a firm's strategy, whether it be to grow through acquisition or develop new products and target markets, and these should be incorporated both at planning and implementation stages. Decision making is relatively obvious. Decisions made throughout the firm are challenged with appropriate balance to include the interest of customers. There need to be controls in place, ensuring TCF risks are incorporated into the risk framework, with appropriate controls and management information to manage, monitor, and take action where issues are identified. Recruitment, training, and competence is another issue. Staff's behaviour can shape the culture of a firm, and this can be influenced through recruitment and training processes and the ongoing monitoring of performance. And finally, they identified reward. The structure of reward strategies can play an important role over staff behaviour and the treatment of customers. For example, having reward strategies that are not only based on the achievement of sales targets, but equally take into account the quality of sales advice. The other big moves in regulation this year were Solvency II. On the 10th of July 2002, CHEOPS, as I pronounce it, published a proposal for the Framework Directive on its Solvency II project. The framework allows for a more sophisticated solvency requirements and proposes the following three pillars for insurance regulation. Pillar 1 deals with quantitative requirements, Pillar 2 with requirements for the governance and risk management of insurers and the effective supervision of insurers, and Pillar 3 deals with supervisory reporting and transparency requirements. Also during 2007, results from the third quantitative impact study into the effect on the EU Solvency II regime have been published. And we'll just briefly look at some of the conclusions with that. The UK industry seems to be measuring up well. The FSA's results were given by sector. This shows that the Quiz 3 solvency ratios of actual capital held relative to the SCR are more consistent in each sector compared to those in Solvency 1. So the industry's attempts to hold capital, suitable capital against risks are going reasonably well. More work is needed on calibrating the minimal capital requirement. There is substantial variation in the ratio between the MCR and the SCR for different companies. This suggests that the approach tested in Quiz 3 was not sufficiently risk sensitive. In some cases, for example, this ratio was actually negative. In view of this, three alternatives are being considered for Quiz 4: a recalibrated version of the modular approach used in Quiz 3, a compact approach that derives MCR as a percentage of the SCR, and a linear approach that determines MCR as a percentage of the technical provisions and other risk drivers, similar to the current method under Solvency I. Then we look at the lapse catastrophe risk calibration. The calibration of the lapse catastrophe risk requires holding 75% of the surrender strain, which was an area of concern for linked life providers. This calibration overstated capital requirements and had a significant impact on the company's solvency position. More work is needed here, as the current calibration is not at a reasonable level. Actions of life companies' management need to be better taken into account. The KC factors suggested in Quiz 3 to measure the firm's solvency before and after actions by its management remain an area of conflict. The results show that the methodology to allow for profit sharing suggested in Quiz 3 could understate the SCR. Insurers have requested that the methodology is reviewed and that basic capital requirement is derived net of management actions rather than using the factors approach. And finally, we move on to the other impact that's going on in financial reporting, the timetable for IFRS for insurance contracts. In May 2007, the Accounting Standards Board released a discussion paper on IFRS for insurance contracts. This is the second phase of the contracts project, which in 2005 introduced IFRS 4. The proposals set out in the discussion paper would introduce fundamental changes to insurance accounting and focus on market-consistent measurement of insurance liabilities. The discussion paper outlines the board's preliminary views on the main components of the Phase 2 accounting model for all insurance contracts, including life, non-life, direct insurance, and reinsurance. It sets out 20 specific questions and highlights a variety of issues, some controversial, following a six-month consultation which closed in November 2007. An exposure draft is expected to be issued by 2009. This exposure draft will expose the comprehensive standard on the recognition and measurement of insurance contracts. The final standard is expected in 2010 and will replace the current temporary dispensations under IFRS 4. The main proposition in the discussion paper is that all the insurance liabilities be measured using the current exit value using the following three building blocks. Current estimates, which should be explicit, unbiased, market consistent, probability weighting, and current estimates of the contractual cash flows. There should be an allowance for the time value of money, and there should be margins in to allow for the margin that market participants require for bearing risk. Typically, the CEV of an insurance liability is not observable, so it must be estimated using the three building blocks described above. The purpose of this measurement is to attribute more useful information and help users make economic decisions. And this hopefully will be more consistent with what is coming out of Solvency II. So that is the life insurance section of the paper. So I'll lead on to Claire Edler to talk about general insurance.
I'm going to start by giving an overview of the current topics in general insurance paper. I'll then go into a bit more detail on some of the topics which you might find of particular interest. These are 2007 catastrophes, climate change, subprime, and Solvency II. This presentation and the paper aim to provide an overview of the current issues and trends seen in recent times in the general insurance industry. The paper is split into four main themes: market developments, claims, modelling techniques, and regulation. The market development section, in that we give an overview of the market for mergers and acquisitions and discuss the increasing interest in catastrophe-linked securitisation within the insurance industry. We also consider the runoff market and discuss developments in the reinsurance market cycle. In the claims section, we provide an update of the major loss events occurring in recent years, which are generating uncertainty in the current reserve estimates. We consider the potential for emerging issues such as climate change and the credit crunch to generate large losses in the future. We also update on current recent legal developments in asbestos and personal injury claims. In the modelling techniques section, we include a review of the new techniques available for estimating reserve uncertainty, and we look into some of the issues actuaries need to consider for reserving in a soft market. In the regulation section, we discuss the impact of recent regulatory changes in the context of the changing capital requirements as a result of Solvency II. We also look at the wider impact of the European Union introducing IFRS and review developments relating to Part 7 transfers. I'll now give an overview of the 2007 catastrophes. After a relatively benign year for catastrophes in 2006, 2007 soon proved to be a higher than average catastrophe year. Barely 3 weeks into 2007, Windstorm Kirill swept across the UK and parts of Northern Europe, killing 47 people. The insurance loss for this is expected to be £2.3 billion. The UK was affected by widespread flooding in June and July. The total loss to the insurance industry for this is around £3 billion. The 2007 Atlantic hurricane season was the first recorded season with two Category 5 storms making landfall. These were Hurricane Dean and Hurricane Felix. They didn't lead to particularly large losses to the insurance industry, as they did not hit widely populated areas. Hurricane Dean was $1 billion and Hurricane Felix was less than $0.1 billion. To put these in context, the current estimated loss for Hurricane Katrina is $70 billion. Other catastrophes in 2007 included the California wildfires, with a $1.9 billion insured loss, and Tabasco floods with a $0.7 billion insured loss. I'll now give a bit more detail about climate change and how it's affecting our profession. Climate change is increasingly becoming an acknowledged reality. While the debate still goes on about its causes and whether it's a phase or a long-term trend, its existence is generally accepted. The overwhelming majority of scientists believe that humans are responsible for this greenhouse gas warming. Climate change is expected by experts and scientists to impact the world economy in many ways. There are a wide range of opportunities and threats, not least for insurers. Events in 2007, such as the Californian wildfires, flooding in the UK and Asia, and drought in Australia, were all partly attributed to climate change. The 2007 hurricane season was a lucky escape for the insurance industry. Increasingly, the signs are that climate change-related events are occurring now, and we can no longer speak of these issues as a future concern. A questionnaire was put to the actuarial profession in October 2007 on the implications of climate change on our work. The profession's views on climate change were varied, but there was a consensus on some issues. 83% of those surveyed believe climate change is real, and 58% also thought it was likely to have an impact on their work. Of those, 52% believe that current assumptions need to be modified in order to incorporate climate change into non-life and pricing and reserving models. To summarise, climate change is real and is not adequately reflected in current models. I will now go into a bit more detail on subprime lending and the credit crunch. In February 2007, New Century Financials, the second largest subprime lender in the US, announced that its financial statements needed to be revised due to loan losses. This took the global economy by surprise. Its filing for bankruptcy in April, followed by several reports of losses from financial institutions and real estate industry services, impacted the liquidity in financial markets. The US subprime mortgage crisis has had, and will probably continue to have, an impact on the insurance industry. Despite not being affected as strongly as the banking sector, the insurance sector has still suffered some losses. The key uncertainty remains on the scale of the impact. The main areas affecting the insurance industry are investments, traditional insurance exposure, in particular directors and officers, and errors and omissions exposure, bond insurers and mortgage insurers, and general economic difficulties, as there is still uncertainty about whether a general economic fallout will arise, and if so, to what extent. Several companies have already reported losses as a direct result of the subprime crisis, including Bear Stearns. Bear Stearns has been particularly badly affected by the subprime crisis. On March 16, 2008, JP Morgan announced its acquisition of Bear Stearns, the fifth largest US securities firm, for approximately $2 per share. This is down from $100 per share at the end of 2007. This fall in share price was notably as a result of its internal hedge funds collapsing last June due to high investment in mortgage securities. Yesterday, JP Morgan has revised this from $2 per share to $10 per share. The period between November 2007 and January 2008 saw a tripling in the estimated cost of the credit crunch on the insurance industry. This is from $3 billion to $9 billion. It's difficult to assess the impact, especially as it takes a few years to have a precise idea of the amounts involved in such claims. There have been 170 claims filed through Lloyd's to date. The level of liquidity has been affected in many countries, which will be the case for some time and will affect the wider economies. There is uncertainty surrounding the effect on reinsurance rates. But could there be a silver lining? With the low perceived correlation between insurance and economic risk, investors may seek to enhance returns on their portfolio through greater investment in the insurance industry. I'll now go into a bit more detail on capital and Solvency II. As we move closer to Solvency II, the use of internal capital models is likely to become even more widespread. The results of Quiz 3, as Peter spoke about earlier, and the likely structure of the SCR formula means that for most companies of a reasonable size, an internal model is likely to give rise to a lower capital requirement than the standard formula. This is due to areas addressed such as catastrophe modelling, reserving uncertainty, and operational risk. Any internal model must, however, have regulatory sign-off. The key requirement is that the company must be able to demonstrate embedded use of and belief in its own model. The time and effort needed to get the process up and running is considerable, but the benefits of internal models is thought to be fully worthwhile. Going forward, it's expected that companies which currently don't have an embedded internal capital model will devote more resources to the development of such a model. Time is running out fast for those companies who wish to fully benefit from Solvency II when it comes into force in 2012. Our surveys have demonstrated that not much attention has been given to Pillar 3 of Solvency II yet. As this comes increasingly onto the corporate radar, we expect many questions to be asked about the validity of the models, which may lead to several new exciting fields for general insurance actuaries. To summarise, our paper is split into four main themes: market developments, claims, modelling techniques, and regulation. And I've discussed some of these in more detail. If you'd like to know more about anything I've discussed today, then you'll find more information in our paper. I think there'll be questions at the end. I'll now hand over to Matt and Femi about investments.
Okay, Femi and I are going to talk today about the implications of a credit crunch for investment policy. So just by way of an agenda, first of all I'm going to look at the trends in defined benefit scheme investment, and move on to a bit of background to the credit crunch. Claire's covered a bit of this already. Then Femi's going to talk about the implications for hedging. I'm going to come back again and talk about LIBOR generation in the current environment, and then we'll wrap up with some conclusions. Okay, so just to set the scene, what are the trends in defined benefit pension fund investing at the moment? Well, things have changed quite a lot from 10 years ago when there was traditional balanced strategies followed. And trustees were most concerned about how the assets did compared to their peers. We're in a different world now. There's a lot more regulation, and there's a lot of marking to market as well. So by marking to market, I mean calculating a market value of liabilities. An example of that might be to take the cash flows, so the benefits due and expenses from a pension scheme, and value those using a swap curve. So in the current environment, we have, on one side, we have liability-driven investing, which is finding assets which match your liabilities, and therefore hedging out what we might say is unrewarded risks. So examples of those might be interest rate risk and inflation risk. And then also you have it's typical to have a return-seeking allocation where you're trying to earn returns in excess of the liabilities in order to generate excess returns and reduce the contribution rate that effectively has to be paid by the employer. And that sort of has two aspects. We have a market return component, which is the return that can be taken from investing in passively, say, in an equity index or a bond index. And then we have this alpha component, which is sort of your pure manager skill or your absolute return investments. And the idea here is to generate return which is uncorrelated. One of the key issues in the beta and alpha is to diversify both. So diversify your active manager skill and the sources of market return. Okay, some background on the credit crunch. There's been low interest rates and quite lax lending over the sort of the past 3 or 4 years or so. So I've always felt there's a bit of a credit bubble building up. And the trigger for this crunch was the US housing market. And with US subprime mortgages resetting to higher interest rates and also US house prices falling, I think they've fallen by about 10%, which is the first time they've fallen since the 1930s, which is somewhat ominous. And effectively, that led to repricing of risk in the asset-backed securities markets, difficulty in refinancing, and the big thing that happened that sort of made this crisis spread into the wider asset class is the fact that banks stopped lending, so there's a liquidity dry up. And when liquidity dries up, there's no short-term financing, so investors have to unwind what were already leveraged positions. Therefore, you get forced asset sales, falling prices, and then lending dries up more, and you get into a bit of a vicious circle. That's where we are now. Okay. Just before we move on, actually, just wanted to point out on this graph the movements in LIBOR. It's been relatively stable at about 30 basis points over base rates, but there's been considerable volatility due to the credit crunch in recent times. So what environment are we in now? Well, the prices of return-seeking assets have generally gone down, and those of the risk-free or matching assets have gone up. So as we might expect, equities have underperformed, and corporate bonds have underperformed relative to gilts. Now, this presentation we're going to focus on matching assets. So we're going to focus on the gilts and the corporate bond element in your liability-driven investing. Also, we are in an environment of lower economic growth, considerable uncertainty, and that brings with it volatility, and higher commodity prices. The oil price has increased by about 90% over the last 12 months, and gold just over 50%. So you put those three things together and it does give quite ominous signs to what might be ahead. Okay, I'm going to hand over to Femi now to talk about the hedging aspects.
Thanks, Matt. Hi, all. What I wanted to do today was, rather than spend too much time on the economics of the credit crunch, just wanted to bring out the salient points for pension plan investors, as Matt said. And with that as a background, I think one of the good starting points is to look at gilt yields, so the sort of yields you'd use to discount to your liabilities. And at the top half of this page shows the iBox gilt graph. I think that's readable from where you guys are. And for me, this graph highlights the rising in yields from about 4.3% at the start of 2007, and a nice general trend upwards till the credit crunch hits. And what tends to happen in financial stress typically is that people run for cover, so they fly to quality, as they say. So what happens then is people buy gilts at pretty much any price, and the yield then starts to fall off, and you can see the I suppose decidedly downward trend over the second half of the year. So that was one of the key points for me. The other point from the top half graph, from top half of the page, I think, is the volatility that you can see in the first half of the year compared to the second half of the year. But gilt yields, I suppose, looking at that from the start to the end, there hasn't been much movement. So it starts at about 4.2 and ends maybe at about 4.4-ish. But the journey from start to end is actually quite volatile. The second cut I took of interest rates was to look at the nominal yield curve. So looking at a curve based on zero coupon gilt, looking at the return on each of the gilts at different points in time, or gilts of different terms. And what you can see from the bottom half of the graph is the way the nominal yield curve has fallen from where it started. So that means your liabilities have typically gone up. And the second point of the nominal yield curve at the bottom is the way it's actually become less inverted. We've been living with a downward sloping yield curve for a while now, but it's now starting to be, I suppose, relatively upward sloping or relatively flat. And that's particularly relevant for pension funds, because one of the things that's been relatively popular is the concept of liability-driven investments. So investing in swaps that match the profile of your liabilities. Now, while that matches the value of your liabilities, there's a sort of servicing cost, because what happens is you tend to pay short-term floating interest rates and receive long-term interest rates. It's basically how the hedge works. So once that's on, you effectively borrow at short-term rates to earn long-term rates. So the extent to which the curve becomes less inverted actually reduces your servicing cost of the swap, because your short-term rates, which used to be relatively high, have now moved down to your long-term rate, so your interest rate differential is less severe. Moving on to the real yield curve, so again, just the real yield against the term, you've got the same picture, or a relatively similar picture. The absolute level of the real yield curve has fallen, so again, it has the same effect on your liabilities and the cost of matching those liabilities. There are a number of reasons that you can point to for driving that particular move. One is whether people are just becoming much more risk averse, so pension funds are paying more for inflation protection because they, it's on rewarded risk, so they want to get rid of it. So that could be the trend. It could be relatively high demand compared to supply. Been speaking to asset managers and banks, and the anecdotal evidence is that hedging has actually trebled over the last 3 years, which is significant. So that could be another reason for that. You know, as demand gets higher and higher and supply isn't coming through, then the price of that product will typically rise, whether it's insurance against inflation or whether it's any other product. So that could be the second reason for that, or second part of that move in real yield curves. The third could be actually an expectation that we're headed for stagflation, which would be an environment where we've got pretty high inflation but pretty low economic growth. And what you'd normally see is as economic growth slows, inflation comes down because people can afford to buy less, and there's a natural equilibrium there. But what the fear in that last scenario would be is that commodity prices keep rising. So you get this unnatural increase in inflation despite the fall in economic growth. So that could be another reason why we're seeing a relatively lower real yield curve. As Matt said, one of the things we wanted to look at was not just gilt, but was to look at corporate bonds as well. So at the top there, I've plotted the gap between the yield on a corporate bond and the yield on a gilt. And it's useful as an indicator of risk appetite. You know, the higher the credit, the credit spread, the more people are demanding to be paid for taking on risk. And as that falls, then it means people are relatively risk-seeking. You don't have to pay them too much to take on credit risk. And I plotted it going back to the start of 97, and I'll explain why in just a second. But one of the interesting things about the credit crunch is that the credit spread, as you can see, over 2007 has just rocketed. What that has meant is it's actually risen by more than the gilt yield has fallen. So we started off the presentation looking at the fall in gilt yields, and now we're talking about the credit spread actually growing at a faster rate. So what that's actually meant is that when you add the two, the yield on corporate bonds has actually gone up. And for those of you in pensions, the yield on the corporate bond is what you typically use to discount your liabilities by when you're looking at accounting numbers. So one of the interesting outcomes of the credit crunch is that if you're looking at your FRS 17 or accounting numbers, they don't actually look that bad. Your liabilities have actually moved the right way. Whether that's actually permanent or not, I think is probably highly debatable. But it's certainly one of the, I suppose, good news items of the credit crunch, if you could call it that. So your liabilities on an accounting basis don't look too bad. Corporate bond performance. I won't flick back to the start of Matt's presentation, but if you cast your mind back, corporate bonds have actually, the returns haven't been that bad. You certainly would have done worse if you'd been in equities. You'd have done better still if you're in gilts, true. But corporate bond returns haven't been that bad. So I suppose looking at credit, or corporate bonds, it's the good news story, or the least bad news of the lot. What I wanted to do was then plot it going back, because credit crunch is clearly important. But what you can see is that credit spreads behave in a particular way when there's financial stress. So if you look back at some of the peaks in that graph. They go back to things like starting from left to right, things like the Russian debt crisis, the Asian currency crisis back in sort of late 97, 98. They spike back up when you look at the dot-com bubble bursting, and the last being Enron and WorldCom. So credit spreads do act as a pretty good indicator of where things are. With credit spreads at where they are, one of the interesting things for pension funds is whether there's actually an opportunity there. Because if the yields are going up and then the prices are going down, one of the interesting questions is whether you buy. And there are a couple of challenges there. One is that they keep going up. So timing it is actually pretty darn difficult, and the liquidity actually transacting and getting your hands on some of those bonds can be difficult, because corporate bonds are corporate bond markets are slightly different to equity markets in terms of, rather than being traded on an exchange, they tend to go through market makers. So if I'm a market maker and I'm less comfortable with the way the market's looking, I might not do a lot of trade because I need capital on my books and I'm taking on risk and matching buyers with sellers. So timing it is difficult. Actually transacting it is difficult and expensive. But one could take the view that with credit spreads being this wide, it's possibly an opportunity for investors, especially if the Bank of England and the SEC or the Fed actually are willing to prop up organizations as we've seen in a number of cases. So you could hope or you could expect that you could take a view that the default risk is possibly reduced in these sorts of environments. So corporate bonds, as I say, possibly an opportunity for pension funds and other investors, but there are certainly some issues there. What I then wanted to do briefly was to then look at what's actually driving those credit spreads. So, you know, if you take a broad brush, which is what the top is, you can see credit spreads widening or increasing, but you could drill down and see where that widening is coming from, which is what I've done at the bottom. And I hope you guys can read that. The blue line is the non-financial bonds, so bonds, debts of non-financial organizations, and the red line is the yield on the debt of a financial organization or a bunch of financial organizations relative to gilt. And what you can see there is that the red line, certainly towards 2007, is actually the main reason for the increase in yield. So what we're seeing there is, whereas historically the relationships have been the other way around, the yield spread on financial organizations is actually increasing more than that of non-financial organizations. So the opportunities in terms of credit, you'd need to be careful, clearly. It's not necessarily uniform in terms of where the spread drivers are coming from. Second way I wanted to cut that very quickly was to go through the different credit ratings. So AAA being relatively good quality credit, and AA being less so, and single A being less so. And what we can see in 2007 is the first striking message for me from that graph is actually the relative stability of the AAA line hasn't actually moved that much, certainly in comparison to the AA, which has fanned out a bit more, and single A as well. One of the interesting points of that is if you look at the proportions of financials in each of those credit ratings, you'll find a relatively higher proportion in the AA and single A indices. So possibly the effect of that, the effect you're seeing in terms of credit rating is quite possibly a proxy for the financials versus non-financial split I was talking about a bit earlier. But certainly, if you cut it by credit rating rather than issuer, you see a fanning out of credit spreads. And again, it's fairly indicative of risk appetite, where they've been relatively close in terms of what they return, given that they're different quality. It possibly makes more sense that now that they're a bit more fanned out, maybe that's a more normal situation to look at. But going back to the credit crunch, one of the key aspects of financial stresses is that cash becomes king. People tend to hoard cash, tend to sit on cash, and tend to be very reticent or reluctant to lend to other people, which is, as Matt says, one of the indicators of the credit crunch. But if we step back and think about who actually wants liquidity and who's actually got liquidity, then it's quite a sensible conclusion to come to when you think about the hedge funds, as Claire was saying earlier, who actually gone under. A number of them tend to get into trouble because they take a lot of short-term financing and they roll that over and roll that over and roll that over. And to the extent that they can't get their short-term financing, they get stuck, they need to reduce their positions. As Matt says, they become forced sellers, they get less than great prices for their assets. So those sorts of investors desperately need liquidity, but pension funds are actually almost exactly the opposite. Pension funds don't, in the main, need the level of liquidity that they tend to have. So you get to this situation where, again, you've got natural cravers of liquidity and natural suppliers of liquidity. So in a credit crunch situation, you'd expect that quite apart from being paid for credit risk, you'd expect that there's a liquidity premium as well. There's a premium for lending money at this particular moment in time when no one else is doing so. So that's potentially another opportunity for pension funds. I'll just hand Matt over to talk to you about LIBOR generation, which.
Okay, I just want to quickly talk about the mechanics of swaps, really, which can form part of your LDI portfolio. And I mentioned before about hedging out risk. A key message I want to get to you from this slide is entering into a swap contract does not remove all your financial risk. You still have to generate LIBOR. So let me talk you through an example. Consider a pension fund that's fully funded, £10 million assets, £10 million worth of liabilities. We'll just assume for simplicity that those liabilities are fixed rate liabilities. So they're pensions that, say, increase at 3% a year fixed. And the pension fund can enter into a swap with an investment bank whereby it pays the short cash rate, LIBOR, to the bank, and it in return receives a swap rate, which is a fixed swap rate. But this structure requires the pension fund to be able to generate LIBOR, but you can't generate LIBOR risk-free. You can generate LIBID, which is the risk, the rate at which you can lend short term, but this is about 12.5 basis points below 7-day LIBOR. And then also, under a swap arrangement, you're not paying 7-day LIBOR, you're paying 3-month LIBOR. So there's also a term premium there as well. And in the credit crunch, at certain times, that premium has really risen quite dramatically. Has been around 20 to 30 basis points, but it got up to nearly 100 at times. So, in summary, LIBOR is a challenging target. You can't generate LIBOR without taking risk. So, there are a few ways you can generate LIBOR. For example, you can take credit risk. For example, you could invest in AA-rated securities at the moment. That would, current market conditions, just about get you LIBOR. A year ago, you needed to invest in BB-rated securities to generate LIBOR. You can take interest rate or duration risk. So in times of an upward sloping yield curve, you can invest in longer term securities to get a term premium. Or you could take currency risk by investing in cash rate, short cash rates in a different country, which may be higher, or you have an expected appreciation of the exchange rate. And you could also take liquidity risk. So you basically extract the liquidity premium which Femi mentioned earlier. One example of this could be to enter into a facility with an investment bank where they implemented total return swap, and effectively they're paying you for paying you a liquidity premium. Okay, I'll just hand back to Femi now just to sum up.
Thanks, man. All right, guys, just to sum up what we think the main points of the credit crunch has been for pension plans. I'll go through them in terms of the order of risk that Matt's just talked about. One of the key risks for pension plans is interest rate risk. There's pressure on the risk-free rates. There's a flattening and lowering of the yield curve, which is making your liabilities increase, and the servicing cost of your swaps, if you already have them in place, it's actually reducing them. And in terms of inflation risk, as I say, the outlook for inflation is probably more uncertain than it would normally be. That could serve to explain partly why inflation hedging is going at such a premium. In terms of credit risk, credit spreads are at very near all-time highs, but they were a little while back, so last quarter, and the story was probably the same. So in terms of timing when you actually access that opportunity that credit spreads might present, that's proving quite difficult. In terms of what's driving credit risk, it's categorized by sector and by rating, but the volatile atmosphere might actually be conducive to some active managers to add value. In terms of liquidity risk, as I say, when there's a drying up of liquidity, you start thinking about natural providers of liquidity. One of the pension funds could certainly be one of those. So there's possibly issues there or opportunities there. But in terms of LIBOR, i.e. the interbank offer rate, it's been challenging. So if you've got swaps in place, that's proving quite a challenge. And as Matt says, it's one of the risks with liability hedging. You do have an obligation under your swap. Thanks.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Nico Aspinall, and I'm here to talk about current issues in pensions. Just to give a quick summary of what I'm covering, I'm going to first of all look at accounting issues for pensions, quick summary of the activity involving pensions in mergers and acquisitions, look at trends in pensions provision, a quick note on mortality, which is a sort of personal favourite of mine there, a little bit of discussion about the pensions regulator, some consultations that have come out this year, and then a quick note about the movements in the Pension Protection Fund. So as Femi said, one of the most important sets of indicators we have for accounting are really the AA-rated corporate bond yields, which are the high-quality corporate bonds. Bank of England measure of inflation, I think that's generally been accepted, although potentially sort of moving away from that in the future, as the sort of market implied inflation. And I've put in there also the FTSE All Share Return. These are good proxies for the types of indicators that companies will use to discount their pension liabilities, and obviously to estimate future increases. Although there has been, there is definite debate over the sort of duration of that individual yield, and there's also scope there to use a yield curve to form those assumptions. The yield curve gap would probably be sort of a US gap, where you're talking about, I think the wording in the standard is the market value that you could settle the liabilities at, whereas in the sort of UK GAAP sort of standard, it makes specific reference to an individual bond. So I think there will be probably greater movement there towards a yield curve measure that potentially for the bigger pension schemes. Overall, though, there has been strong rises in corporate bond yields, which are form the discount rate, which have not been outpaced here by market implied inflation. So, all in all, we've got rising net discount rates. There's volatility in the equity values going in, and other market asset values, and these together. The volatility in asset values have not offset the reductions in liabilities, and overall, we've had an improvement in accounting values of pension liabilities. This graph here shows the Deloitte estimate, the FTSE 100 accounting position, and you can see where the credit crunch hits, sort of in the middle of this graph. There's a slight decay there in terms of accounting position, but this does carry on in terms of reducing deficits. Now, this really puts us in a position in terms of corporate accounting, which we haven't been in for certainly a long time, which is the position of having surpluses on the balance sheets. Now, we have... Therefore, this year there was a determination released by the International Accounting Standards Board, IFRIC 14, which discusses how much of a surplus should be recognised on the balance sheet of a company. Now, the amount recognised essentially should reflect the amount of economic benefit that the company can take from it. So if there is commitment here to make contributions on a funding basis, which has identified a deficit in the past, then there needs to be a playoff here between the FS 17, which is the UK GAAP number, and the amount actually recognised on the balance sheet. Now, this is one of the sort of key areas that an actuary can add value in terms of how a company understands its deficit and long-term funding position. The ASB, quite recently, has issued some proposed changes to accounting standards, accounting practices. These have some quite big headline impacts, which were focused on by the media. One of them is the move of discount rates to a gilt-type rate. Some estimates out there sort of 120 basis point movements, which for that FTSE 100 graph adds about £90 billion pounds. So they're quite big figures. There are some measures here that could soften that blow. There is a movement to an accrued benefit obligation as opposed to a projected benefit obligation, which is the bottom left one here, so reduced dependency on future salary increases. There are moves contained here which may or may not soften that blow, so actual returns of assets would be used instead of expected. Now, these proposals were released by the National Accounting Standards Boards, the International Accounting Standards Board, the ISB. The chairman later commented that these proposals were essentially not going to be fully implemented. I think the quote is that they had gone further with the proposals than they were likely to with the standard. So watch this space in terms of how accounting standards will change in the future. It is likely, however, that some of this will be implemented in the future. Okay, so turning to mergers and acquisitions. I'm very aware that the credit crunch has come up in the previous three presentations, pretty much. For the sort of M&A aspect of it. I think it very much sort of divided the year in two. Prior to the credit crunch or the sort of real explosion of awareness of it in August, there were some large transactions. Alliance Boots was purchased by KKR, which completed, I think, in August. It was £11.5 billion purchase. Now, this was financed by what's known as a covenant light, where essentially the triggers on the security were reduced so that banks essentially were given less warning of when the covenant would be under threat. And the flip side of this is that the pension schemes were slightly more worried about their future security and were able to secure in the deal a £1 billion package, which consists, I believe, of £600 million of security of charge over assets type security. So that would be in the event of an insolvency type event. Following the credit crunch, there was a sort of reduced level of activity. A number of reasons for that. Don't want to go into it too much, but obviously private equity, if they're financed by banks, then seeking credit to make a purchase is very tough. There are, however, other sources of credit in terms of non-banking, and sovereign wealth funds who are funded by private governments were able to make some attempts. Sainsbury's was attempted in, I think, September to November by a Qatari-backed fund. Sainsbury's had earlier pumped, last year pumped, I think the figure's about £400 million into the pension scheme already. In the deal, the Sainsbury's trustees, it was mooted that figures were talking about £2 billion to be stuck into the pension fund as a result of the transaction. The transaction eventually fell through. Now, the future of M&As, I think we are seeing a situation where a number of companies with high credit exposures will be into sort of distressed debt positions, and the parallel here being Bear Stearns. So there will be some level of M&As going forward. As asset levels have fallen in the last sort of 2 weeks, there is also therefore, you know, greater opportunity to buy companies on the cheap, and I think M&As will sort of maintain its strength going forwards. Looking now at the trends of pension schemes in terms of what's being actually provided for members, this is looking at the current position of defined benefit schemes in the UK. I don't think there's much surprise to see that a large percentage of them are closed to new members. Slightly surprising to see that 14% are closed to, only 14% are closed to future accrual, and that 19% is still open, so people are still joining final salary or career average, I guess, pension schemes coming into that statistic. That 67% statistic, I believe, has gone up sort of between 10 to 14% in the last year. However, I think one of the big worries in terms of actual provision is the amount that gets contributed into pension schemes. Clearly, you know, contribution rates into a final salary scheme might range between sort of 20 and 30%. Obviously, that's very expensive for companies. And one of the big worries would be that you replace it with the DC scheme and you're, you know, saving a huge amount, and that is at the expense of the provision for the member. What we have seen, this is the ACA current pension trends survey. What we're seeing here is that there is actually an increase of amount that companies are willing to contribute into DC schemes. There are possible muddying effects as sort of slightly larger schemes and large companies have been added into this data sort of later on. But overall, there has been a sort of positive growth in company contribution rates, and actually without the same similar sort of level of growth in employee contribution rates. So one of the key things that companies wish to do with their remaining pension liabilities is to de-risk. So there are obviously investment type ways of doing this, which would be hedging the liabilities. Buyouts, there are a couple of quite large scale buyouts this year. I think a number of companies have come into the market, and there was hope that potentially this market might be a bit more buoyant. I think the time will tell. There's been, yes, in the blue one, the two relatively large transactions, this was P&O and Rank, £700 and £800 million respectively, I think. You know, there are some funds out there where there could be a buyout of, you know, 30 billion, might not be an unreasonable figure. So very much, it's very clear that sort of only the smaller ones have bought out so far. It remains pretty expensive to buy out. There's still a margin of between 20 and 40%. That has probably reduced as a result of the market becoming more competitive, but again, it's still quite a large amount. There's possibility to do partial risk transfers, or interesting reinsurance arrangements have been arranged, have been suggested, where essentially you reinsure the deficit on a certain set of assumptions, although I haven't seen any implemented in practice. And another possibility is deferred liability management, where you essentially encourage deferred members to leave the pension scheme. These are members with relatively small liabilities, and you can encourage them in a number of ways to leave, partly by potentially by enhancing their transfer value or offering them cash alternatives. And this reduces essentially non-actuarial costs, which you may well incur. Okay, straight on to mortality. So what we're seeing here are a number of base tables which apply probably in the year 2000. It becomes a little bit academic to a point. What has happened during the year is that the CMI, which is the Continuous Mortality Investigation, SAPS, is the Self-Assured Pension Scheme survey, has issued its proposed graduations in January 2008. Member firms actually received them, I think, in August last year. And this is the first set of mortality tables which have actually been based on pension scheme experience as opposed to life office experience. And I think the sort of headline here is that the yellow and blue lines, I'm not sure how clear they are, the light blue, the light blue especially is lying above, ahead of, above all of the other lines on the curve. The darkest blue is PMA 92 projected with the medium cohort projections up to 2000. And then the pink line there is the double zero tables, the naughty tables, which are the normal retirements there. So there is a possible conclusion from this graph, which is that pension schemes have actually slightly overstated mortality. I would say that's a bit of a jump to go straight away there. But certainly in terms of base tables, I think this sort of muddies the water slightly in terms of the actuarial debate. And it, the most important thing really is research into projection methodologies for future mortality. The actuarial profession has continued to debate and look into models. The CMI, I think, discussed the Peacebine and Lee Carter models back in 2005. And the Cairns-Blake Dowd model has arisen in the last a similar sort of period, but I think it's been more adopted by the actuarial profession over the last year. From a pensions perspective, I would certainly say there's little consensus emerging as to which method to use. The pensions regulator has recently discussed mortality assumptions and has issued a consultation on them. The proposed assumption, a method of setting assumptions there, is that base tables, essentially the mortality that experienced by a pension scheme this year, or in a specific year, can be set relatively easily by looking at scheme-specific mortality, the assumption that the regulator has set out is that actually future improvements cannot be. And therefore, one of these three models I put up here, and there are a number of other ones, is probably more useful. The pensions regulator has actually leaned towards suggesting the long cohort improvement improvement tables. Just to give a bit of background, the cohort improvement factors are based on projecting forward the 92 series tables, which were understating the period of lives born between 1925 and 1945. The regulator has potentially missed out a couple of points on the long cohort tables, i.e. that they should only really be used in terms of the actuarial recommended advice on the 92 series, and I think we'll see them being applied to the 00 series. But I'd say that certainly pensions actuaries are more likely to be using the cohort table still, as opposed to one of these statistical models outlined here. And that certainly comes through in the accounting assumptions. Most common, by quite a margin, is the PMA 92 using the medium cohort and year of birth. There are some early adopters who have picked up the 00 series. I think in terms of what we're saying in terms of life companies and buyout valuations, you're far more likely to see a 00 series table in that kind of set of assumptions than you are to see it in a pension scheme accounting type assumption. There are still a number of the older tables, PMA 80 is an example, being used as an accounting assumption. And although discussed by the pensions regulator as not being particularly appropriate, there are still adjustments using changes, reductions to discount rate to project into the future, age ratings and K-factors. So moving to the pensions regulator, I think this year has been really the first year that we've seen the teeth of the new regulator. Obviously the pensions regulator replaced OPRA a couple of years ago. Sea containers determination, that's the pensions regulator issued a financial support direction to Sea Containers Limited to help improve the security of the pension scheme, which was the first time it had issued an FSD there. The FSD power, the power to make sure that a sponsor doesn't leave behind pension liabilities, is probably the strongest power that the pensions regulator has, and it is the reason that it is the fact that makes buying and selling companies in the UK very pension specific, pension reliant. The pensions regulator issues has a process where companies who are buying or selling companies can go to the regulator and ask for clearance before they actually go through the transaction, and receive assurance that the pensions regulator won't come along and later ask for more financial support to be offered to the pension scheme. I believe in this case clearance wasn't sought, and this is really the sort of warning sign for corporate transactions that if there's any doubt that the security will be impaired to a level that they believe the pension scheme would be, the pensions regulator would be interested, that clearance should be sought. The second use of trust of the pensions regulator powers, which is relatively interesting, is the tenant trustees. The pensions regulator appointed an independent trustee onto the board of the tenant trustees, and this is the first time again that the pensions regulator has done this. Scheme specific funding, I've had a quick put a quick note on here. The employer covenant really speaks to that point about the FSD, that the pensions regulator has highlighted the importance of trustees when forming funding assumptions to consider the covenant that their sponsor offers to the pension scheme. And he's also, as I mentioned before, come up with a consultation on mortality assumptions. There's the pensions regulator has oversight of funding assumptions in the first year. I believe he took one third of pension schemes, the assumptions they had used for funding, in for additional scrutiny. The majority of those did not require any further action, except for some clarification of what the assumptions were and how they had been come to. Further 10% he intervened on. The impact of the mortality assumption consultation from the pensions regulator as the source is that roughly 99% of pension schemes are likely to trigger one of the points for scrutiny. This, I think, is one of the more important points that the pensions regulator has come out, and it's one of the bits that the actuarial profession and the pensions regulator will need to discuss over 2008. Other consultations that have come out are on DC schemes, which I think there's a parallel there between the TCF parts of the FSA, and conflicts of interest. Probably from an actuarial perspective, the key point there is about advisor conflicts, and obviously there are a number of situations where the actuary may be advising both the corporate sponsor and the trustee, and the consultation here is from the perspective of the trustee, but I think there's an important discussion that the actuarial profession can have into that bit as well. The other main conflict that he identifies there is the conflict of trustees who hold senior positions within the corporate sponsor and then also positions on the trustee board or are trustees. Okay. So the main role, explicitly stated role, of the pensions regulator is to ensure that to reduce the likelihood of companies and their pension schemes entering the PPF, the Pension Protection Fund. The Pensions Protection Fund currently has 115 members of formerly pension schemes where the sponsor had formerly gone insolvent. Of those 115 members, 1,500 odd are pensioners in payment. And the way the levy has been calculated will change this year. It's still going to be a similar number, which is $675 million, but actually he's reduced the way that it's calculated so that the schemes at the highest risk aren't forced into paying the most, and therefore producing a greater likelihood of triggering insolvency event on the company itself, and therefore producing a vicious circle. So the sort of the actual distribution of how that money is collected will pass more onto the lower risk schemes. Okay, that's me. I think we'll be able to talk about that.
Okay, so does anybody have any questions for Pete and his team? No? Okay, shall I hand over to Ronnie?
Now, the lights up. I don't need any screens or anything for this. They say that the credit crunch was a 1-in-100-year event, and blimey, if we only had one, then we get, hardly have we had that one, then we get another one, namely a free drink from Deloitte. And I realise that I'm all that's standing between you and that second 100-year event, so I'll try and be as quick as I can. But I was, as Zoe said, the arrangements for consultation on the merger are in something of a state of flux with the proposed meeting that was to be tomorrow to be changed. And I thought I'd take this opportunity, since we've got a few people gathered together, just to do three things. Firstly, and very quickly to give you a brief summary of why the Faculty Council and indeed the Institute Council are recommending to its members that the two bodies should merge. So that's the first thing. Secondly, just to in part repeat what Zoe said about what the consultation process is. And thirdly, and most importantly, to encourage you to come along on the 16th of April, both to the consultation meeting and those of you who are faculty fellows to stay behind for the special meeting so that we can get as representative a vote at that meeting as possible. So just those three things, if I may, just for a few minutes. It was my privilege to chair the task force that looked at all the options for the faculty, because the faculty has made the running on this, and we put forward three options to Faculty Council, and out of that, Faculty Council decided to recommend to you a merger. And the reasons that Faculty Council decided to recommend a merger were that we and the Institute Council want to put the profession onto the front foot. We've been taking a bit of a bashing for nearly a decade over Equitable Life, over with-profits funds, over defined benefit pension schemes, and even over longevity. We've done a lot of work to tidy up the back-of-house things within the profession, a new education, new discipline, a whole new structure, and we feel we're in the position where we can actually go out onto the front foot and actually make an impact. And although tonight's presentations have mostly been about the traditional areas, you got a glimpse in Claire's talk of climate change and the other. And if you look at the number of interesting places where actuaries are involved, you can see that not only could we be getting on the front foot to remind the public just what a lot of value actuaries already add in the traditional areas, but also to think about some of those new areas and get across the fact that actuaries and actuarial training can add values in hitherto unexpected areas. So we want to get out to the public who might use our services. We want to make you, the members of the profession, feel proud to be part of the profession. And when you see actuarial profession in the papers, you don't want to look away and fearful of the next disaster Norma Cohen at the Financial Times has found to crow about. And also, we need to make the profession one that young graduates want to choose above all the other attractives, because otherwise there isn't a lifeblood to the profession. So Faculty Council, there are only 6,000 fellows in the whole of the UK, of whom about 1,000 are faculty fellows, and only half of them work in Scotland. We're a tiny profession. The Institute of Chartered Accountants of Scotland has 50,000 members. It's 50 times the size of the faculty. If we want to make any kind of impact, we need to focus the effort. And as a tiny profession, only 6,000 people across the whole of the UK, and we felt that merger was the best way to get us fully onto the front foot and take our PR to the nation. But it was clear from Faculty Council and from surveys that we wanted all that stuff, but selfish people that we are in the faculty, we wanted to keep all the good stuff, we wanted to keep the traditions, we wanted to keep the loyalty that's produced all the volunteers, we wanted to keep the sessional meetings and meetings like these in Edinburgh. So we wanted everything. We wanted our cake and we wanted to eat it as well. And so we entered in with some apprehension to negotiations with the Institute on what sort of deal could be struck. And if the Institute fellows would all just cover their ears for a minute, we couldn't believe that we got everything that we asked for. So we've got an endowment fund for research, which has been a particular thing of the faculty over the years. We've got guaranteed places on all the key committees, which are more than proportionately we would be entitled to. We've got an additional guarantees for various things, for those who like that kind of thing, it'll be the faculty crest, it'll be the faculty constitution, it'll be the faculty motto, and those who wish to keep the designation FFA, who've already got it, can keep that as well. So we don't feel that we could have got a better deal than the one that we got, and we are very apprehensive that if we don't get the merger on these terms now, and we have one of the kind of stick and paste solutions that are being talked around in some quarters, and we then come back to negotiate a merger in 10 years' time, we'll get a far worse deal in 10 years' time than we've been able to negotiate today. So that's why Faculty Council is keen on it. Institute Council is keen on it because it believes in all the focus points and getting some focus to the work of the profession. And it's happy in the interests of being a good neighbour to smooth the way with the concessions that I've described. So that's why we're going. It's, what we are keen, though, is that to have as wide a possible consultation as we can. And as you heard, the first of those was supposed to be tomorrow night. And I think there are about 10 across the UK over the course of the next 6 weeks. And then the intention, and still is the intention, to have an in-principle vote in June. And very unusually, possibly uniquely, the in-principle vote will be open to students as well as to fellows, because in a way it's, you know, the future of the faculty is more important to students and young actors than it is to old blokes like me. So we want that consultation. There will be a postal vote, so everybody, it doesn't matter whether you're in South Africa, you'll have an equal say in the matter as you would if you were a retired actuary living in Edinburgh with lots of time in your hands to go to special general meetings. But not that I'm bitter in any way. So that's what we intend. The special general meeting that's been called is a perfectly legitimate constitutional thing, and it'll follow on from the consultation meeting on the 16th of April to which you're all invited. Unfortunately, because of the nature of a special general meeting, it will only be faculty fellows who can vote. And that's a bit of a shame given the broad number of people who can do this. So I would encourage all of those of you who are faculty fellows to come along and stay behind for the special general meeting on the 16th. Otherwise, there is a danger that meeting gets populated by retired actuaries living near Edinburgh who've got time on their hands and not people for whom the future of the profession for the next 20 or 30 years is so important. If the four resolutions that have been put forward by the group of 10 people who have requisitioned the meeting, if they are defeated, then we'll go back to Plan A, which will be to have the in-principle vote, and then in a few months' time, a formal vote on all the details of this stuff. So that's all I wanted to say. The message is, please, you know, I have some views on this, Faculty Council has some views on this, but it's not for us to decide, it's for you, the fellowship of the faculty to decide what it is you want to do, having heard the arguments. So do come along. Please try and get the other folk from your office to come along as well. It's in this place, and it would be, given the momentous nature of the decision, it would be good to have this place as full as possible, on which basis I shall keep you no longer from Deloitte's free drink, but I'm happy over a drink to answer any questions you may have. I'm very grateful to Zoe for fitting me in tonight. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, five of you for coming along to speak to us, and we look forward to getting the paper that should be on the website in the next few days. So, yeah. And thanks all for coming. Thank you.
Being used to serve the past couple of days, I've
liked it. Oh, no, it's all right.